Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and I'm glad you could join us once again as we go through the boxes and binders and other random locations of your cardboard collection. And we've got an interesting set. One of those sets that you have good memories of, and you look forward to ripping open a box full of these cards, and then afterwards you're just like, meh. You know, it's kind of like the donut syndrome. I don't know about you, but I don't eat donuts as much as I used to. I used to eat a lot of donuts. Then again, I used to be really fat. And every now and then I'll have one. I hardly touch the things these days. But every now and then you're just really hungry. And maybe you're in the break room at your office. And somebody just leaves half a box of Dunkin' Donuts or Krispy Kremes or Tim Hortons or whatever the local donut shop is in your neighborhood. And part of you goes, I really shouldn't. But then the other part goes, remember how good these used to be? You should have one. And you open the box and you find the best looking one and you eat it and it's kind of good. And then about an hour later, you're going, what the hell was I thinking? Why did I eat that? That's the best way I can describe the set, or at least my experience with it this time around, that we're looking at this week. 92 Fleer. This was a box of cards that's been sitting in a closet of mine for a few months now. And like a lot of the junk wax bargain bin boxes, I picked it up at a recent card show here in Tampa. And there's a lot of good things to 92 Fleer. We'll get into the history of that particular set. Why, even though it is part of the junk wax era, in fact, 1992, the turning point where baseball cards went from mostly fun to very annoying in terms of price, in terms of oversaturation, over insertion, if you will. And, you know, a lot of the problems that collectors complain about today, you could trace back to 1992, because that's when everybody tried to have that premium look and premium feel, even though it wasn't really a premium set, or they were just, you know, lapped by the competition. And that was certainly the case with Fleer. But a lot of Fleer's troubles in 1992 were of their own doing, especially in 1991, and we all know that story. So we'll talk a little bit about the 92 Fleer, a little bit about the bargain bin box that I purchased, and it actually plays into the topic we brought up about a month ago with junk wax getting hot again. And we've got some commentary from listeners I want to share, people who commented on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, not only about the 92 Fleer set, but also about some recent quote-unquote junk wax sets that we've looked at and about the effect that junk wax is having once again on the collecting market. So we'll cover all that today. Plus, from the four packs of 92 Fleer that I opened up, we will take a peek at four players, one player from each pack or one card from each pack, tell you a little bit about some of the players that you may have forgotten about over the years, some players who were better than you may remember, other players who were just as awful as you may remember. And then you've got a couple of oddballs as well. And we'll touch up on that too. As I mentioned, our Twitter feed is at Wax and Gum Stains. It's open 24/7. Make sure you tell a friend or a fellow collector that the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed is open. And we take your comments and questions and thoughts about the hobby, also the shows that we do, the sets that we talk about, the players that we feature in the programs as well. And of course, we always take suggestions for the show too. So again, Wax and Gum Stains at Twitter, and it is a great place for card collectors of the past, or if you're still collecting today, to jump on into the conversation and let us know what you are thinking. Now, this week's podcast, I'm actually recording a couple days earlier than I normally do, but I can tell you that our 92 Fleer pack break is up on YouTube. Just type in Wax Ecstatic 92 Fleer break and you will find the video for that. I will confess, before we talk about the entire box opening experience and about the set, that the four packs that I randomly pulled, they were just the top four packs from the box, not exactly loaded with hit cards or big names, and that's evident in some of the individual cards that we're going to talk about in today's show. But I can tell you, even though the video break is less than inspiring because there weren't that many great cards in the four packs that I opened, there were some good ones, but nothing great. I did manage to pull a few notable cards that we'll talk about a little later on. But again, if you're looking for that link, just go to YouTube, type in Wax Ecstatic 92 Fleer Wax Break, or again, just look up our timeline on Twitter, Wax and Gum Stains. That link came out on Thursday. Now, our next podcast will be coming 2 weeks from today. That will be on Friday, July the 5th, I believe it is. And I always get my dates mixed up. But anyways, 2 weeks from June 21st, if that helps you. I believe that is July 5th. And we will work something around the 4th of July holiday. And I'm looking to get into some more vintage stuff, putting out a few bids for some older packs. Hopefully we can win them. If not, then I do have some still just sitting in storage, some from the early 80s that I picked up from other lots over the past couple of years, and they just haven't been opened yet. So we may revisit a couple of early to mid 80s sets that we've already discussed. And also, I would suggest if you're looking for something that puts you in the patriotic mood, check back into our archive via audioboom.com or all of our various channels, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, Spotify, you name it. It's out there everywhere, our podcast is. If you go back, it would be episode, I don't know the number right off the top of my head. I want to say like 83 or something like that. But 76 tops, we were looking back at Rick Monday. And of course, around July 4th, you think of Rick Monday, even though this particular event didn't happen back on July 4th or even around July 4th. It was actually very early in the season. If you go back to that episode, you can listen to us talk about the infamous Rick Monday saving the American flag incident that did happen at Dodger Stadium when Rick Monday was a member of the Cubs, and a couple of hoodlums jumped out onto the field and tried to light the American flag on fire. Monday came in, swooped away the flag, and became a national hero, and still is more than 40 years later. By the way, episode 89 is the episode. Episode 89 titled "Oh Say Can You See 76 Tops" and is one of our many odes to the 76 Tops set. And that is one of the packs that I'm bidding on, hoping we can get a good deal and open up some vintage wax here on the next show. Now, if you would like to contribute to the show, be it giving us funds to help purchase these products, or if you would like to just help keep the show in good form, that is paying for our annual fee to keep us on Audio Boom and all the various channels I already mentioned, you can make donation at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. And whether you have just a couple of bucks or 20 bucks or more than 20 bucks, whatever you have, we greatly appreciate it. And again, the money goes straight back into the program, either the maintenance on our Audio Boom base and the maintenance of our archive, as the show is now well over 135 episodes, I believe now. So we've got that many that we like to maintain, and we've been doing the show for almost 3 years now, so you can go back in time and listen to some of those older shows, such as episode 89, like I just mentioned. Also, it goes into the purchase of the products, so whether it's packs, whether it's boxes, whether it's just lots of cards, even if it's just a few dollars, it goes right back into the program, so keep that in mind. And also a reminder, any excess product that we have, so let's say, for example, I do open up a box of cards and I don't feel like hanging on to 500 more cards from 1992, then they do get packed away in boxes and then shipped off to one of two I don't want to call them charitable because technically they're not, but not-for-profit operations, which are Cadority cards and Commons for Kids. Now, Commons for Kids will be getting the next batch of cards, and it's not just cards from the early 1990s. No, I've got some current cards, some duplicates that I've pulled aside, and also some bonus duplicates that I pulled out from my boxes of late 70s and early 80s cards. So somebody at Commons for Kids will be getting the 76 Tops Texas Rangers team card with the big Texas scoreboard in the background and Billy Martin featured in the little manager inset photo. And I just happened to discover I had a couple of those cards. So somebody at Commons for Kids will be getting some late 70s and early 80s Tops, as well as some early 90s and some more recent Tops Heritage cards. So know that even if that money that you donate to the program, we end up buying boxes and boxes of cards, I'm not keeping them. We're actually putting them back out into the collecting environment, if you will. And with Commons for Kids and Cadority cards, you've got two great groups who are putting together cards for kids. And that helps keep the hobby going through these donations, whether it's new cards or slightly older cards, as the case may be in the early 90s. Then the kids get to experience baseball cards. And that's a big thing, to not only keep the hobby going, but also keep kids interested in sports, in particular the sport of baseball. And in a day where everything is digital, it's nice to actually hold the hard item in your hand and actually sift through the cards like we used to do when we were kids. So your donations at paypal.me/waxecstatic go a long way towards the maintenance of our website and the various streams that carry the podcast, also towards the purchase of products, and then through the donation of these cards to Commons for Kids and Cadority cards. And thanks, we had a couple of donations over the past couple of weeks. We appreciate it, not only for helping us keep the program going, but also my threat of opening that rack pack of 89 Bowman. Well, that Bowman rack pack goes away for a little bit because we do have some additional funds. But remember, if the donations dry up, I will threaten opening up that 89 Bowman rack pack once again. And we certainly don't want to unleash that Kraken to the collecting world anymore. Even though I kind of liked 89 Bowman, I know the vast majority of our listeners do not. I also want to thank you on a personal note for letting me do the special Father's Day show a couple weeks ago, of course, in memory of my late father, Kevin, who passed away a little over a month ago. And I know it was a little different because the format of the show changed just a slight bit. We weren't focusing on one particular brand or one particular year or one particular type of cards. It was just five random cards that I pulled from my collection that somehow brought back memories of my father and his connections through baseball and baseball cards. And like I said in the show, you know, my mother was very instrumental in getting me started in collecting baseball cards, but certainly my father did an awful lot as I was collecting to tie his experiences in baseball and his memories and observations into my current collection. And it was also a very big reason why I collected some vintage cards, not only because I was just curious and buying older cards from the 60s and 70s when I was a kid, but it was a link to history, and in some cases a link to things that my dad did or saw. So even though there was a little bit of a moral message throughout that entire program, I do thank you again for letting me do that. Not that I was going to ask your permission anyways. It's my show. I'll do whatever the hell I want to. But, you know, it was a little bit of a deviation from the norm, and it was a show that had to be done given the circumstances, but also just the rather fortuitous timing. You know, we were doing that show the week before Father's Day weekend, and it just seemed right at the time, and I'm glad that I was able to do it. And I do, you know, I have received several condolences messages and also direct messages through Wax and Gum Stains, people sharing stories about their father or, you know, like I said, just condolences. And I do appreciate it. Those messages do go a long way in helping me cope and move forward. And as I mentioned in the show, I'm doing okay for reasons that I discussed in the show. And if you haven't heard it, well, just go to the archive and click on the last show. To Dad, Love, Matt was the name of the program. And follow up on my advice if you get the chance there, because it helped me a tremendous amount. And hopefully it helps you, again, if your parents are still alive now or even if they have passed or you can't connect with them for whatever earthly reason, you can move forward knowing that every box is left unchecked. Now, some other commentary coming through the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed, and a lot of it dealing from the prior show to the last one, so two shows ago, when we were talking about 91 Tops. I've always enjoyed 91 Tops. And, you know, it's the last fun card set is what I call it. It's one of those sets that I took a long time to complete to hand collate, but I did. But even the leftover cards from this particular box, you know, right now they're sitting in a box, but I'm thinking, I'm considering, I'm going, well, you know, maybe I should put together just one more set from these. I did get a couple of Chipper Jones out of the box, but no Frank Thomases, so I'm going to have to do a little work on that particular set. But we had a lot of comments about that particular set, as well as just collecting cards from the mid to late or early 90s or mid to late 80s, as the case may be. You know, junk wax often, you know, I put it in a time span of 88 to 93, but it depends on the collector. Some people start as early as 86 or even 81 when Fleer and Donruss came around. But most people agree that, like, the junkiest of junk wax came out certainly in the late 80s and early to mid 90s. And I've always been pretty upset about the term junk wax. And that's why I often put it in quotations, because one of the big reasons why I've done this show over the last few years is to not only talk about the hobby and go digging through some classic cards and sets, but also to dig around and take a second look, or in some cases a third look, at particular sets from the late 80s or early 90s. And a lot of the times, I'd say probably 9 times out of 10, you look at them and you go, you know, these really aren't that bad. And I think a lot of fans will agree with me on that. Nick at Vosprink, responding to one of the tweets promoting the show, which featured the legendary Walt Weiss card, where Walt Weiss is airborne turning a double play at second base, comments, "My favorite card from one of the top three sets Tops ever made." And that's quite the compliment to 91 Tops, but arguably the 91 Tops set was the best set from Tops in the 90s. And some will say, you know, you can even stretch that back, you know, if you look at just the last 30 years of Tops baseball cards. Some people like the 91 set, put it in the top spot or the top three, as the case may be. Also, Jason D saying, "This is an absolutely fantastic set, always will be." James Stork commenting, "Been graphing this set for a while now, about 150 or so signed, beautiful picks like the Boggs." Yes, the Boggs picture, Wade Boggs card, is a great one. You know, I mentioned the Roger Clemens card and, of course, the Walt Weiss card. But, yeah, the Wade Boggs one, if you remember that, that was taken from the ground looking up at Boggs in his hitting stance. And, you know, you had the evening sky behind him. You know, it's just like right at the end of sunset where, you know, there's still light coming up from the horizon, but it's not overwhelming. A very dramatic picture. It's a great shot. Tim also comments, "91 Tops is some of the best photography of any set ever produced in the history of mankind." That is also very complimentary. I will say, even though 91 Tops had a very simple design and was still going with the gray cardstock and the bubblegum back then, it was definitely one of those sets that photography-wise matched anything that Upper Deck had out at the time, or Score, or, you know, Tops would certainly set the bar for Stadium Club photography, but some of the other premium sets from later on, Fleer Ultra and, you know, sets like that, photography was always sharp. But 91 Tops, even with some of the older design factors of it, still put together some great photographs, and that's what makes the 91 set so legendary. Now, speaking of bubblegum, Kirby Thomas Jr. recently did a June break. So he was going through 9 packs of cards, and it looks like it was 91 Donruss that he was going through. And he commented and actually tagged me in this. It says, "Wax and Gum Stains talks a lot about the smell of the cards as a nostalgic trigger. I totally get that with these cards, more subdued than I remember, but it's probably because these cards are 28 years old. This is how I remember baseball cards smelling and takes me back to childhood. Well, one reason why the cards are subdued in the smell is 91 Donruss, of course, didn't have the bubble gum. And 91 Donruss, that was the last year that Donruss had their kind of standard cardstock, the cardstock that they've been using since really 1982. Which was, a white base stock, but a little flimsier than Fleer, but easy to read. You didn't have too many issues with not being able to read the back of a Donruss card, even the years where they used dark blue as a color, such as Series 1 of the 91 set, also the 86 and 88 years, although 86 had a little lighter blue, but 88 Donruss with the dark blue background. The card stock was able to make anything look brighter, even some of the blurry, dark photographs that Donruss was notorious for in the early 80s until, they figured out how to lay out a nice card set by 84 and 85. So that's part of it. You're not only smelling cardboard and ink, but also cardboard puzzle pieces. If you really want the nostalgic trigger of the old baseball cards, you have to go to Topps. Or you can do this with 81 Fleer or Donruss, but it's not quite the same. But you need to go to Topps, and you need to go to 91 or earlier. Now, thankfully, because this is the junk wax era, you can buy a lot of these packs for ridiculously cheap prices. In fact, if you go to certain card shows or even card shops, some dealers will just give you these cards. They don't want these packs anymore, so they just put them in the, hey, take one pack free, or if your kids go to you with these or go with you to these card shows or card shops, he said confidently. Sometimes the dealers will sell these card packs or give them to the kids for free. So, that's a great way to get the nostalgic smell of not only the bubble gum, but it's that perfect trifecta, particularly in the 80s. But you do get it with these cards from the 70s. And again, 1990 or 91 Topps, you get this. It is the, as I call it, the toxic aroma, but it's toxic in a good way, not like a hairspray toxicity. No, this is a great toxic smell of bubblegum, the gray stock cardboard, and the wax. Now, I know 91 Topps wasn't wrapped in wax. That was their first year of doing cellophane, but you still get the cardboard and the gum smell in 91. But if you go 1990 and beyond, prior to that, you can pull cards out of the, wax packs or jumbo packs, as the case may be. And I'll admit to this, this is very nerdy. But hey, it's a baseball card podcast. How much nerdier can it get, right? I love, actually, after opening up four or five packs and you're stacking these cards up, I just take the whole stack of cards and I just jam them right under my nose and just go, because that smell, even 30 plus years later, it's still in there. And every time I smell that smell, it takes me back. And likewise with Kirby. So thank you very much, Kirby, for sharing that story with us. Also, speaking of nostalgic cards from the Father's Day show, comment from Chris Castagnola. My apologies if I mispronounced that, but his handle is Top72, which is rather appropriate considering his comment was on the 72 Topps Nolan Ryan card that I was talking about in the program. And I'm actually just finishing up an authorized biography of Nolan Ryan, which is a great book about the making of a pitcher. And I highly recommend it, by the way. Came out, I want to say 2013 or 2014. And one of Ryan's sons, Reed Ryan, I think commissioned the book. So Nolan Ryan has his own autobiography that's out. It was released in the early 90s. But the Southern Nolan Ryan book is really a great read. Very simple, just flat out. Easy to read. It's in chronological order. It's not too difficult to tackle. And hearing or reading about some of the troubles he had in New York, especially with Gil Hodges and trying to break through that pitching rotation. You had Tom Seaver and Jerry Kuzman and Gary Gentry. It was hard for Ryan to break through, so he kind of forced that trade to California and, of course, had some incredible success with the Angels. And, you know, Chris mentions that this is a great card, an all-time great player, and it is. And it's not only a great card for a great all-time player, but also one of the worst airbrush jobs in great card history. Of course, the Angel logo, it's actually, you know, the hat is not that bad. It's just, you know, what typically happened with the airbrushed cards, teams that wore pinstripes, you know, the pinstripes seemed to carry over from old team to new team. Even though this was a later series edition, that was card number 585, I believe, with the 72 set. So you would think Topps would have found somebody who could have traveled to the Angels spring training and gotten a picture of Nolan Ryan and his new duds, but they didn't, or if they did, they just weren't very good pictures, which is a possibility. Going back to the junk wax thoughts, Chris Pullman sent us a couple of pictures, one of a page of 91 Topps, one of a page of 92, and he comments, your Is Junk Wax Making a Comeback episode inspired me to take out the 91 and give it the once over. I was a senior in high school in 91, great memories of the set. And then he follows up, after looking through the 91 earlier, I decided to scan through the 92. Junk wax be damned. These sets are so much fun. Exactly, Chris. And by the way, he put junk wax in quotations. These are, you know, just fun things to open up and fun things to look through. And if you want to try to put together a set, it's fun and relatively cheap these days to do it. And that's the main driving force behind that. Not only is it a chance for you to look back at some of those cards that you collected as a kid and to have a greater appreciation or a new appreciation for these sets, but to also just have fun with it. And I think that's something that has been missing from baseball cards for many years, is that, and we all know the reasons why. The cards got more expensive. There were too many of them. There were too many sets of subsets on top of subsets and inserts and, you know, refractor colors and all that stuff, that it just got too frustrating to buy cards. You know, we all long for the days of just plunking down, you know, 25, 30, 50 cents, as the case may be, whenever you were collecting, getting 15 or so cards, that slab of rock hard bubblegum in there, and just trying to find your favorite player or your favorite team. Now, those days are not coming back ever. So, you know, don't click your heels three times and hope that happens. That's not going to be the case. But you can still have some fun at an affordable rate with a lot of those cards from the late 80s and early 90s. And again, you're having fun. You're doing it at not too big of a cost in most cases. And you're helping the dealers. Nothing makes the dealer happier than helping them unload some junk wax era baseball cards. Trust me. They will mark down the prices. In some cases, they'll give you a bonus few packs or boxes. They just want it off their hands, and they will do whatever it takes to do that. And if you're in the market for the quote-unquote junk wax, that is good news for you. Now, like I said, in a lot of these podcasts, when we're talking about late 80s and early 90s cards, you're not going to get rich off of these. You just simply aren't. Now, in some cases, you can make some money. And again, you know, I'll use the 91 Topps Chipper Jones examples. If I wanted to take those two Chipper Jones cards and send them off to PSA or Beckett Grading or whomever, you know, somebody can look at them and grade them a 9 or a 10 if I'm so fortunate, and then I can resell them for a few hundred dollars. But that's not why I'm doing this. And that's certainly not the main reason why we do this show either. It's just not why. Again, you know, it's an option if you want to try to make money off these cards. But in most cases, you're just not going to. And remember, too, even if you're lucky to get that PSA 8 or 9 or 10 of a card fresh out of a pack and you're able to resell it for, you know, a few hundred, or as the case may be, a few $1,000s, depending on the card, you know, the other 791 cards in the set, you're just not going to get anything for. So I had somebody on the Twitter feed a few weeks ago criticize me for suggesting you can even make money off these cards. And again, that's not the main reason why we even have these discussions about the bargain bin beauties, as I like to call them. And, you know, this week's 92 Fleer is a prime example of that. So, you know, don't think that we're trying to move the needle on the market. What I did mention in that Junk Wax Is It Coming Back program, the box of fat packs of 91 Topps from a few weeks ago, is that yes, indeed, junk wax baseball cards are coming back, but buyer beware, you're going to get some sales pitches from some people who have bought up hordes of these baseball cards, and they're going to try to sell you on the idea of, hey, remember those cards you collected when you were a teenager? They're worth money now. And, you know, it's like bad real estate deals. It's like subprime mortgages. Somebody's just going to try to sell you a bad deal of just bad baseball cards. So, you know, if you want to collect junk wax era cards, do it because it brings back good memories, or because it's fun, or it's just a, you know, a cheap way to kill an hour or two, you know, on a rainy day or what have you. Or, you know, you want to introduce your kids to baseball cards, or it's, you know, you take your kids to a card show and you buy some of these and you're comparing new cards to old cards. Don't go in thinking you're going to make money. The only people who are going to make money off of junk wax era baseball cards are the dealers. Now, whether it's the snake oil salesmen who try to pitch you to buy boxes of 1,000 cards in the hope that you're able to pay off that mortgage with those cards, don't buy from those people. Really, the only other people are, as I mentioned in that show, card dealers who, for many years, they were able to sell a box of, you know, 92 tops for $8. Well, now they can mark it up to $10 and somebody will pay for it. Keep in mind, in 1992, that same box of cards cost $20, $22, $25. So, yeah, they're making a little more money now than compared to maybe 3 or 4 years ago on that box. But dealers are not, you know, raking in the dough off of late 80s or early 90s baseball cards. Again, you're really just doing them a favor by unloading it. And if they can squeeze an extra couple dollars out of you, then they'll go ahead and do that. And the case in point, that 92 Fleer box that I bought, and I mentioned this in a previous show, you know, I bought it for $15 at a card show a few months ago. Well, that exact same box from the exact same dealer was being sold for $20 at the last show I went to. So, hey, good on this dealer for believing that the market is heating up just enough to where he could mark up that box of cards another $5. I even thought of this as I'm going through the packs here. I'm like, yeah, I paid $15 for it. It's a little more than I would normally pay for some bargain bin boxes. I've been very fortunate. I've bought some recently for $7, $8, $9 a pop. So yeah, $15 is a little higher than I would normally go with. But at the same time, you know, I remember, you know, buying a box of Fleer back in 1992, and I had to mow a couple yards to make that happen. I think it was $25 for a box. So, you know, $15 isn't such a bad deal. A couple other quick comments. Actually, one more here from Suspicious Cat. I always considered 1991 separate from junk wax. Yes, there was a ton of them produced, but that is one of the best Topps designs ever. Again, you're not going to find too many people that disagree with you on that. 91 Topps is arguably the best Topps set of the 90s and arguably the best Topps set since 1987, which is, of course, very popular. Not everyone likes it, but most people do. So, you know, you're not going to find too many collectors that dislike 91 Topps. But it does fall into that junk wax era. And that's why I don't call it junk wax. It's just the junk wax era, quote unquote, because that's what people have called it. I don't like that name. But yeah, you know, there were literally millions of each card from the set produced. So 792 times, let's just say 5 million. That's a whole lot of cards. So, again, you're not going to make money off of it. You're not going to make a living off of it, but you can for, it's, what did I pay for that cello box? $20 for that box. I've bought, you know, some wax boxes from 91 and 92 for, you know, $8 or $10 a piece. It's cheap fun, and you can get it nowadays more than ever. So if you're just looking for a little bit of nostalgia, whether it's the smell of cards or just the thrill of opening up packs or finding some of the rookie cards and star cards that you used to, you know, pack away in those top loaders when you were a kid and now they're only book value at 30 cents, this is the thing to do. And by the way, 90s nostalgia is just coming back with a vengeance, isn't it? It's crazy. It's not totally unexpected, though. I've recognized this basically every decade, and it's all because of, you know, kids who are entering their midlife crisis age. So the kids who are in their early to mid-30s, typically every decade, into your early 40s, you long for the old times. And for whatever reason, the human body, the mind, goes back 20 years or 25 years, for whatever reason, the human mind just tends to go back to when we were teenagers or roughly around there. And all you have to do is just, you know, look back in, you know, the 1970s. You know, there was nostalgia for the 1950s. It came through on Happy Days and American Graffiti, you know, those movies that came out. In the 80s, the nostalgia was back on the 60s. You know, it's in the movies like Platoon and Full Metal Jacket and the TV show The Wonder Years. In the 90s, we went back to the 70s. After all, there was a show called That 70s Show from, you know, the late 90s. And that also started my infatuation with the lovely and talented Mila Kunis many, many years ago. So, you know, you had in the 90s, people were crazy about the 70s. In the early 2000s, we all, you know, went crazy for the 80s. Well, now here we are, it's 2019, and everyone just has a massive hard-on for the 90s nowadays. And I just want to remind you, as somebody who was in high school and college in the 1990s, not everything from the 90s was good. I mean, you could say the same thing about the 80s and, well, the 70s and 60s and 50s before that. But, you know, I see these things, you know, Crystal Pepsi made a comeback. And I go, why? It wasn't good then. And apparently with some recent or upcoming movie release, there's going to be a re-release of New Coke. Now, New Coke wasn't 90s. That was 1986. But, you know, New Coke wasn't good. That's why it's the poster child of bad public relations and messing around with a good thing. But there's just all this love for the 90s. And, you know, there's some good things that come out of it. The music. Not necessarily the clothes or the color schemes. You know, the 90s, people forget the 90s, you know, there was a lot of teal and, you know, purple and avocado. You know, think of the, you know, Anaheim Mighty Ducks jerseys of the early 90s, which again are classic these days too. But, you know, I guess there's some good things that come out of longing for the 90s. You know, everyone likes to see their old TV shows and listen to the music. But, you know, in terms of baseball card collecting, if you're nostalgic for the 90s, it's a good time to live because even though the prices have nudged up a tiny, tiny bit in some cases, if you want those classic sets, boxes, or lots of cards for the people who didn't throw them out or who the people like me who 15 years ago didn't find a shop to buy 1,000-count boxes of my cards for a penny apiece, then there's plenty of product that is out there for you, and good luck looking for it. Now, speaking of 90s nostalgia, let's take a look at the pack of cards or the box of cards that I opened up recently, 92 Fleer. And yeah, if you're definitely nostalgic for the 90s, this is a great set to do it with because, well, for the aforementioned colors, green, you know, that teal green that was very popular in the early 90s, definitely featured in the 92 Fleer set. And, you know, when I looked at 92 Fleer, I thought about how important of a set that was for Fleer for a number of reasons. As I mentioned before, 1992, a year where everybody went premium. Everybody improved their card stock and improved, you know, the UV coating and the inserts and the autograph cards and things like that. But Fleer had to go above and beyond just the, you know, average upgrade of the card sets like everybody else did because of what Fleer produced in 1991, which is arguably one of the worst sets in baseball card history. Of course, talking about the banana peel 91 Fleer set, the very bright yellow set that even though there were some, you know, big rookie cards and some young star player cards there, you know, when you look at what Topps put out in 1991, or Upper Deck, certainly you had, you know, Bowman was a step up from what you saw in 89 and 90, and Score was okay. Score was very contemporary, but, you know, when you compared Fleer to all the other ones, Donruss was kind of goofy in 1991. But when you compared Fleer to especially the classy types of sets that Topps and Upper Deck were putting out, and of course Topps Stadium Club, which set the bar for premium sets, then you're looking at Fleer going, what the hell is going on here? And as we mentioned in a previous episode about 91 Fleer Ultra, because the Fleer base set was such a debacle, Fleer Ultra kind of stumbled out of the gate too. Now, Fleer Ultra would right the ship in 92 and 93. Some great card sets were produced then, premium sets that, again, you can get at very affordable prices nowadays. But the, you know, the 91 Fleer set was such an albatross that Fleer had to put out an incredible set in 1992. And I think they managed to do that not only with the improved card stock, but also the bright, even though I called it teal, in my opinion, it's really not teal. It's more of a kind of an emerald green. It had a very distinguished look and color that you did not see in the other sets in 1992. So, you know, Fleer was able to put that together rather nicely. But as I pointed out in the card break, as we were looking at a Paul Molitor card that we pulled in one of the sets, or one of the packs, I should say, even though Fleer had this nice design, it was going away from what was being desired by collectors, and that was less borders, less bells and whistles, more pictures, more action, more color. Well, they certainly had the color there, but by the way that Fleer was putting this border around the picture, only about 70% of the front of the card was dedicated to an action shot. A lot of it was to the green border, and then you've got the player's name coming down vertically, his last name from top to bottom, the team logo and the position of the team or of the player, and that took up a lot of room on the front. Now, on the backs of the cards, Fleer really stepped up their game with the full-color action photo taking up about the top third of the card, followed by a complete career stats at the bottom. So what Fleer lacked in originality on the front certainly made up for it on the back. Of course, by 1992, a lot of cards were coming up with full color photos on the back. Topps had the pictures of the stadiums. Donruss had the pictures of players, but they weren't, you know, fully framed. They were just kind of floating in the middle of the statistics there. And of course, Upper Deck had full color photographs on the backs of cards since their debut in 1989. So, you know, once again, Fleer a little late to the game here, but I thought it balanced out well. Again, what was kind of cluttered on the front of the card came up really nice and sharp on the back of the card. Now, as I mentioned, the green color was very eye-catching, very pleasing. The design was very contemporary, too. You know, it looks like it's 1992, but it's not screaming 1992, you know, like a lot of things that were coming up, you know, like Crystal Pepsi in the early 90s. You know, there was a definite contemporary look, but it wasn't tacky. Think 91 Donruss. That was contemporary and tacky. 91 Score, contemporary, somewhat tacky. 92 Fleer was not that case. It was contemporary, but also somewhat conservative, somewhat subdued, and I think it was a nice balance and certainly was a nice dialing back of the over-creativity that Fleer tried to create in the 1991 set. Now, something interesting about 92 Fleer, it was a 720-card set. And in past years, if you go back to 1981, when they debuted as an officially licensed product of Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association, Fleer would organize these cards by team, and they would organize them by how the team finished. So your defending world champions, or in some cases, the team with the best win-loss record, they would be the first team. There would be cards 1 through 25. And then the second best team would be cards 26 through 50, and on and on and on. So you always knew just where a card was, how good or bad a team was. So especially if you're digging through some early 80s Fleer sets, your Seattle Mariners and your Toronto Blue Jays and, you know, your San Diego Padres, you know, they were typically found in the back of the set. And, you know, if you look back at the, you know, let's say 1990 or 91 sets, you know, you have the Oakland A's were at the top, and then you would have, well, what do you know, Seattle was always in the back, or, you know, the Texas Rangers or something like that. Well, in 1992, they decided to just go alphabetically first by American League teams and then National League teams, and alphabetically by the city of the team. So the Baltimore Orioles are the first team right out of the gate. And then, you know, you would just go again alphabetically through the American League cities and then the National League cities, which, You know, okay, so from like an anal retentive standpoint, it makes sense. But from a uniqueness standpoint, I was never a big fan of that. It took kind of one of those neat things about FLIR away. It was too organized. And again, you know, the older sets, you can look at where a card was, you know, what the number was, and you could determine how good or how bad a team was based on the card number. Well, you couldn't do that anymore. Starting in 92. Now, along with the base set, you had the Rookie Sensations cards, which were a nice insert. You also had All-Star cards, which were very nice. Black borders, gold trim, good action shots. This was kind of, I think a lot of people, and we talked about this in the 91 FLIR Ultra set, where, you know, the gold cards that were in the Ultra set, if that was the base card, people would have bought more FLIR Ultra. You could argue, too, that if the All-Star cards, if more cards in the 92 FLIR set were designed like that, then 92 FLIR may have gotten a little more traction than it did back in the day. Not that 92 FLIR was looked down upon, but you think it might be a little more better remembered. But then again, it kind of takes the luster of the All-Star card away. I did manage to pull a couple of All-Star cards. Barry Bonds was the big one. But, you know, some really neat cards from this particular box. Also, speaking of black cards with the gold trim, Roger Clemens career highlight cards. You know, Clemens, it's so funny. Most people remember him from his early years in the 80s and then, you know, later on in his career with the Yankees and the Astros, late 90s, early 2000s. You know, he was really at his prime, and we're presuming, not using performance enhancing drugs in the early 90s. And FLIR decided to have him be part of a special subset. And I did get a couple of the Roger Clemens cards, not the autograph cards, though. There are 2,000 autographed, although not certifiable, but autographed cards that were printed up and signed by Clemens for the 92 set. So this is another one of those hooks for quote-unquote junk wax era cards. If you go back to the early to mid-1990s, one reason why you may still want to buy 92 FLIR or 92 Upper Deck or 91 Tops is some of the inserts. For 92 FLIR, it's the Rookie Sensations, or it's the All-Star cards, or the Roger Clemens cards. For the early 90s Upper Deck, it's a Ted Williams or a Reggie Jackson or a Joe DiMaggio insert. For 91 Tops, the chance of still getting some of those vintage cards that were printed up in honor of Tops' 40th anniversary. So as much, it's so funny, and I was thinking of this as I'm going through these cards and I'm pulling this All-Star card here or this Roger Clemens card here. As much as collectors bemoan the insert card and how in many ways it helped derail collecting cards and making it less fun, that's one of the big hooks why you still buy these early 90s cards today. Because as you're opening them, you're going, okay, well, you know, here's the third Marty Barrett card I got. But hey, you know, if I keep trying, maybe I'll get one of those autographed Clemens cards, or I'll get a Bonds All-Star card or something like that. Because those are the cards that still have some monetary value to them, and they're not your common cards. No offense to Marty Barrett, but I think you get my point. So it's just rather ironic that one of the big complaints about baseball cards in the early to mid-90s is actually one of the benefits or one of the reasons why you still may want to open these cards now, because you still could get something really cool in an insert card that was put into the pack over 25 years ago. So you have those, and that's really all that stands out. You've got some good rookie cards and young star cards. You know, we pulled one of the cards, Mo Vaughn. You know, back in 1992, you would have been able to sell that card for $3, $4, or $5. But you also have cards of guys like Ivan Rodriguez, let's see, who else? Mike Piazza, Eric Karros, you know, a lot of young stars from the early 90s or rookie cards that would have been extremely valuable back then. And of course, like any other early 90s set, you've got the up-and-coming stars. So, for example, we pulled a Tom Glavine card from here. Like I said, you've got Mo Vaughn as well. You got Roberto Alomar, too. You know, Hall of Famers, Ken Griffey Jr. One pack I pulled, and I actually will post a picture of this on our Wax and Gum Stains feed. One pack I pulled a Ken Griffey Jr. base card, a Roger Clemens career highlights card, and a David Justice art card, which even though David Justice cards aren't worth that much nowadays, The art cards were really well done, but also, you know, remember 1992 David Justice cards, you could sell those for $2 or $3 a pop back then. So, you know, I'm looking through some of these. I'm like, wow, there's some real star-studded packs coming out of this box. Granted, they weren't the four that I opened on the video link, but there were some pretty, you know, good hits that were coming out of these packs here. Also, you've got your, you know, the end of the career cards for guys like Nolan Ryan, Paul Molitor, Robin Yount. So, you know, you've got a full spectrum of cards and players that you get out of this set. And it was very entertaining to open up. But like I said at the start of the show, you know, it's kind of the donut situation here, where, again, I don't eat as much donuts as I used to. I hardly eat them now. And those times where you do eat them, you go, yeah, I probably shouldn't have eaten that. And, you know, it's think of anything else where you thought it was a really good idea, and then you're just like, you know, now what do I do with this? You know, maybe it's eating that extra piece of chocolate, or maybe you half-assed that term paper and you didn't get a good grade on it. So, you know, you're trying to make up for it and go, all right, let me try to put in a better paper next time. You know, I really just wasted my time putting together that first one. That's kind of the same empty calorie feeling that I had opening up this 92 Fleer box, because I've had my eyes on 92 Fleer. I have a lot of good memories. And like I said, I've always liked the set, was able to get the box for a good price. Always enjoy opening up old wax packs anyways. So I'm sitting there opening this box up and I'm looking through them. And, you know, as I'm getting about halfway through the box, you know, first of all, you've got some duplication. You know, you could see how the cards were cycled through. So, you know, you're getting those three Marty Barretts or whatever. And it's not until you get to the very bottom of the box that the circulation of cards has changed enough to where you see a little variation. And, you know, now you're thinking, well, if I do want to actually hand collate a set from this box, I can do it. But then I'm sitting there and it's like, I just don't really want to do it. And, you know, do I want to pull these cards together and realize, okay, I need 250 more cards to go? And do I really want to go from card shop to card shop asking for the guy's 92 Fleer collection to finish off this set? And then, you know, like I said, it's the empty calorie feeling. It's like, no, shouldn't have had that donut. You know, nope, shouldn't have had that Coca-Cola. Nope, shouldn't have had that extra piece of chocolate. Nope, should have actually, you know, invested my time in writing that term paper, not just throwing words on a spreadsheet here. So, you know, 92 Fleer, like any other bargain bin buy or any other junk wax purchase, there's some good things, but then there's sometimes after you go through it, you're like, okay, it was fun while it lasted, but it only lasted about an hour. You know, it's, yeah, to put it more graphically, you know, the empty calorie syndrome. Kind of like that hot girl you've had an eye on, you know, maybe it's an old flame and, you know, you hook up and then the morning after you're like, yeah, it's not quite what I imagined it would be like. You know, I think we've all been there at least once, you know, not that there's anything truly bad about that, but, you know, it's happened to you. Let's be honest. You had your eye on somebody and you hook up and you do your thing and then you're just like, my dreams, my fantasies were a little better than that. I think that's what I experienced with 92 Fleer. Although I didn't have to call it the next morning, which was nice. However, again, if you're nostalgic for the 90s, you can get 92 Fleer boxes relatively cheap, anywhere between $10 and $15. Or if you're going to the one table at the one card show I go to, it's now $20. Sorry. Like I said, prices have nudged up a little bit. But it is a fun trip back to the early 90s. It is a nice reclamation project for Fleer. They desperately needed to do it, not only to keep up with the Joneses, but also to make people forget about that debacle of the 1991 set. And I think overall they did it well, even though the 92 Fleer cards I'm not hanging on to. It's nice to go through them, and it's always fun to just open up a box of packs. Any old day, I will gladly do it. And 92 Fleer, you know, I always had a soft spot for Fleer. I always thought Fleer was better than Donruss, especially in the early 80s. I always thought Fleer had some pretty sharp sets in the mid to late 80s. I've loved 1990 Fleer ever since 1990. Even though the cards are practically worthless these days, they're just fun cards to open up. But I always had that soft spot for 92 Fleer because you were rooting for them. After just releasing that absolute turd from 1991, you're like, okay, can Fleer pull it together? And they did, but little too late. You know, everybody else had bypassed them. Of course, everybody was making base sets into premium-looking sets. Everybody was making premium cards on top of the base sets. And Fleer, you know, very similar to Score in the early 90s because so much attention was being put on the premium sets. As Score, you know, the Pinnacle company moved away from Score and put most of their focus on the Pinnacle brand and the other various premium brands. And all card companies did this, but Fleer definitely did this. And I was looking through, you know, before the show started, I was looking through some pictures, you know, 93 Fleer, I barely remember because I honestly don't remember if I actually bought any of those cards. I may have just a few. And then, you know, I didn't buy anything in 94 or 95 or 96. You know, they had some pretty blah designs in the mid 90s. And I remember buying a pack of Fleer from, I think it was 2003, maybe 2004. And it was very uninspiring. It just wasn't the same as, you know, opening up something from the 80s. So, you know, in many ways, 92 Fleer is kind of the last hurrah for the base Fleer set, because as the whole hobby got completely oversaturated and overrun by brands and sub brands and premium brands in the mid to late 90s, and then, you know, you started having card companies just start peeling away, especially in baseball cards, you know, you had some, you know, a lot of the cards looked the same. You know, you couldn't tell a Fleer from a Topps, from a Leaf. You know, they all just kind of looked the same. And then they all kind of petered out before Topps had that exclusive deal with Major League Baseball and the Players Association that still is in effect today and will be for the next several years. So 92 Fleer, kind of the last hurrah for the base set, as there was just way too much in the mid-90s. And a lot of people just kind of moved on from baseball cards in the late 90s when it wasn't as fun and it certainly wasn't affordable to get into the hobby. Now, even though there, you know, I mean, there were some decent cards that we pulled out of these packs here. You know, like I said, Paul Molitor, Nolan Ryan came out of one of these packs as well. Certainly no wow cards. I did find them later on in the box, but I went through the packs and I picked out one card from each pack. So we got four players to look here, including Danny Darwin. This was from the first pack that we opened up. Danny Darwin, it's so funny when you mention a baseball player from, say, 20, 25, 30 years ago, the first thought that comes into your mind. When I say Danny Darwin, two things come to my mind. First, he nearly threw a no-hitter in 1993, and I remember listening to that game on the radio. I'm trying to remember who were the Red Sox playing that. I don't even remember who the Red Sox are playing. Maybe the Angels? I don't know. But anyways, Danny Darwin, of all people, in late August of 1993, went like 8 1/3 innings of no-hit baseball, and then, you know, whoever the Red Sox were playing, you know, eventually got a base hit on him, and that was the end of that. But whenever I hear the name Danny Darwin, that's the first thing I think of, is that near no-hitter that he had in 1993. The second thing I think of is if there was ever a person who just looks like Texas, it's Danny Darwin. And if you have ever seen the logo for the USFL's San Antonio Gunslingers, you talk about debacles. The San Antonio Gunslingers were definitely that. But if you ever see the logo of the San Antonio Gunslingers, it's got this real wiry, stereotypical Texan, you know, reaching for the guns in his holster. That reminds me of Danny Darwin, and vice versa. One kind of looks like the other more than I'm sure Danny Darwin would care to admit. But anyways, Danny Darwin, even though we make fun of his looks, and you know, he's kind of one of those names that kind of passed through the annals of baseball history. This was a guy who played for over 20 years in baseball. Granted, he had to deal with a lot of injury situations over the years, but he made his debut in 1978 with the Texas Rangers, September 8th, 1978, and wrapped up his career in the San Francisco Giants organization. That is until 1998. So yeah, 20 years there with first the Rangers, later the Brewers, the Astros, the Red Sox, the Blue Jays, the Rangers again, the Pirates, the Astros again, the White Sox, and the Giants. You know, certainly nothing to get excited about when you look at his record. 171 and 182, his earned run average is 3.84. And he was also part of one of the worst trades in baseball history. White Sox fans cringe when I mention the white flag trade of 1997, even though the White Sox were just a few games out in the wild card race in the American League, the Sox decided it was better to cash in their chips than try to make a run for a playoff spot. So that's how he went from the Sox to the Giants in 1997. Wilson Alvarez and Roberto Hernandez also with Darwin to the Giants for Keith Foulke, Bob Howry, Lorenzo Barcello, Mike Caruso, Ken Vining, and Brian Manning. So again, it's one of those deals where you understood where the White Sox were trying to get something for what they had, but they didn't get a whole lot, even though Keith Foulke had a you know, decent career as a closer with Boston later on in his career. Still, you know, Roberto Hernandez was an outstanding relief pitcher at the time. Wilson Alvarez, of course, a starter who had his troubles, but the White Sox waving the white flag there and eventually fading from the playoff picture. He is or was a pitching coach in the minor leagues for a very long time and still is. In fact, he was named the pitching coach for the Chattanooga Lookouts, AA affiliate of the Cincinnati Reds prior to this season. Noted for a couple of fisticuff incidents in his career. Once he actually punched teammate Oral Hershiser. This was when they were playing for the Giants. Back in the late 90s, there was a bench-clearing brawl between the Giants and the Phillies, and for whatever reason, Darwin punched Hershiser in the face. Now, again, this was his own teammate, and Hershiser would later claim that this was for something that Darwin thought he owed Hershiser for some past incident from many, many years ago when they were not on the same team. Also, it was a little tense in the Giants locker room. You know, steroids can do that sometime. And Barry Bonds and Darwin got into a pretty nasty argument when Darwin was pitching, and he felt that Bonds was not exactly up to par when it came to playing defensively, or at least having his head in the game. So there you go. Danny Darwin, the perhaps model for the San Antonio Gunslingers of the USFL. By the way, speaking of USFL, if you're looking for a good book, a good history on the old USFL, you definitely want to read Football for a Buck. That was Jeff Perlman's book that came out several months ago. It's a great, great book about the USFL. All right, now here's another name that, you know, again, just kind of passes through the history of baseball. But this guy was actually a hell of a player. In fact, a two-time All-Star, the top relief pitcher in 1991. Now, if I throw out there top relief pitcher in 1991, who are you thinking? You're probably thinking Dennis Eckersley, maybe Lee Smith, Bobby Thigpen. Remember him? Well, no, that was more 1990. Maybe you're thinking Tom Henke with the Blue Jays. You know, there's all sorts of names you can come up with. What if I said Brian Harvey? And he was one of the top relievers in baseball despite some elbow injuries. Well, Brian Harvey definitely fits that mold there. He was an All-Star in 1991, the American League Rolaids Relief Man Award, and your American League Saves Leader for 1991. He would also be an All-Star in 1993 with the new Florida Marlins. Speaking of redemption stories, that was definitely a good story for him. Brian Harvey, born in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, a suburb of Chattanooga, and the combination of two small towns, just the town of Soddy and the town of Daisy, I think it was back in the 1950s, decided to merge. So they formed Soddy-Daisy, Tennessee. And as I mentioned, two-time All-Star, he played for the California Angels from 1987 to 1992. I always had a soft spot for the Angels back then as well, because they were a team that had some really good players. They just weren't that great. And of course, you know, in the American League West at that time, trying to play catch up with the Oakland Athletics was a nearly impossible task in the late 80s and early 90s. So as much as the Angels or the Texas Rangers or even the Kansas City Royals tried to do that in the American League in the late 80s and early 90s, they always fell kind of short. And the Angels, you know, think about it. The Angels had, you know, Dave Winfield for a couple of years. You know, Mike Witt was still healthy. You had Wally Joyner back in the day. You had some pretty decent players, including Brian Harvey, but they were good but not great. So I always had a soft spot for the Angels at that time because they always just seemed to fall just short. Now, as he was dealing with some elbow injuries throughout the 1992 season, the Angels decided to wave the white flag. They're like, well, Brian Harvey's done. So they left him exposed to the 1993 expansion draft. Well, he was picked up in the 20th round by the Florida Marlins, and he became an all-star in 1993. He and Gary Sheffield representing the Marlins at Camden Yards in the 93 Midsummer Classic. And he would pitch for a couple more seasons with the Marlins before, again, arm injuries would shut him down. Now, even though his career spanned only over nine seasons, he still managed to rack up 177 saves and had a very respectable earned run average of 2.49 during that time. His kids were drafted by major league teams. His son Chris Harvey was in the Pirates organization for a few years. Also, Hunter Harvey, drafted by the Orioles back in 2013. Now, another relief pitcher who is probably better than you thought and who also just kind of passed through the hands of time here in baseball, Mike Jackson, although depending on the card, Michael Jackson. And if you grew up on SportsCenter and Baseball Tonight on ESPN like I did, you remember every time Michael Jackson's name was brought up when they were showing highlights. You would hear, I think it was the late John Saunders. I may be wrong with that, but I think it was the late John Saunders. You know, they would say, and now here comes Michael Jackson. And John Saunders would pipe in and go, hee hee, just in the background. That was it. So they would do that every time that they were showing some Mike Jackson highlight. Again, on SportsCenter or Baseball Tonight, as the case may be. I think it was John Saunders. I hope I'm right on that. But anyways, Mike Jackson was better than you thought he was. In fact, managed to rack up more strikeouts, almost as many saves as Brian Harvey, but he didn't have the all-star caliber status that Harvey had. He was drafted by the Philadelphia Phillies in 1983, didn't sign with the team, re-entered the draft in 1984, and the Phillies drafted him again. This time he would sign with the team, moved his way up the ladder, makes his major league debut in August of 1986. After the 1987 season, the Phillies let him get away in a trade with Seattle. So Jackson, along with Glenn Wilson and Dave Brundage, go to Seattle in exchange for Phil Bradley and Tim Fortunio, two decent but not really great players. And, you know, the Phillies thought that, or Phillies fans and writers thought that Jackson was a guy that got away. And that would certainly prove to be the case as he started to, almost in anonymity, which, you know, playing for the Mariners in the late 80s and early 90s, that was the case. He consistently would finish in the top 10 for most games pitched in the American League, would over a couple of seasons recorded an earned run average of 2.90, was very dependable, but again, playing for a bad Mariners team, most people didn't know who he was or what he did. So he's often overlooked, and that would be the case until he was sent to the San Francisco Giants, again, in a trade that is often looked back at, with hindsight being 2020, as lopsided. Now, the card that we pulled from this pack from 92 Fleer features Jackson with the Mariners, but the trade had already happened. He was actually a member of the Giants when the 1992 season started. And so Jackson was traded to the Giants along with Bill Swift and Dave Burba for Kevin Mitchell and Mike Remlinger. Now, Mike Remlinger was a pretty average pitcher, nothing really special about him. Kevin Mitchell, of course, was certifiably psycho, and also the luster of his playing career completely vanished in Seattle. You talk about just falling into a black hole after his time with the Mets and the Padres and the Giants, where, you know, he had some success. he just vanished in Seattle practically, and I'm sure a lot of Mariners fans wouldn't mind if that was the case. Now, the trade looks lopsided, not necessarily for the acquisition or the loss of Jackson to the Giants, but really more for Dave Burba and Bill Swift, two pitchers who would turn out to be fairly decent pitchers in San Francisco for the next couple of years. But as he had started to do in Seattle, in San Francisco, he would continue to be a very reliable setup guy. And that would be kind of the calling card for his career. Later with Cincinnati, a second stint with Seattle, most notably with the Indians, starting in 1997. He was the setup guy for the Indians closer, Jose Mason. Of course, in 97, the Indians making it to Game 7 of the World Series, where they would lose to the Florida Marlins. Well, after the 97 season, Mesa gets traded to the Giants, so Jackson becomes the closer, and he also finished fourth in the American League in saves in 1999 with 39. Now, afterwards, he dealt with injuries and bounced around a little bit. From Cleveland, he would miss an entire season due to injury, then would later show up in Houston, Minnesota, and the White Sox for a little bit of a spell there. But you add it all up, 18 years from start to finish, and again, 142 saves, 1,006 strikeouts, a respectable 3.42 earned run average. Was a great setup guy and a certainly affable closer, was able to meet the needs that the Indians were looking for in a closer in 1998 and 1999. So, another guy that who was better than probably what you remember. Although, again, much like I remember Danny Darwin for that bizarro near no-hitter that he had in 1993, I remember Mike Jackson more for the SportsCenter highlights throughout the years. And last but certainly not least, Mo Vaughn. Nicknamed the Hit Dog, although you could call him the Hot Dog because he certainly hit a few of those in his career. Mo Vaughn, a guy who, everything that was wrong about baseball in the late 90s and early 2000s, you could kind of sum that up in Mo Vaughn. But at the same time, a lot of things that were right about baseball, you could sum that up in Mo Vaughn. Here's a guy who grew up in Norwalk, Connecticut, in the shadow of the Boston Red Sox, would move up through the Red Sox organization, was a star player along with John Valentin and Craig Biggio Seton Hall. That's right. I couldn't remember the name of the college. But, they were big stars in the late 80s at Seton Hall. He was a key part of Seton Hall's Big East Conference baseball tournament success, where Seton Hall would win the tournament. So, you have so many good stories here. He was very involved in the community when he, came up through the Red Sox organization, was arguably the first big star of the Red Sox kind of rebuild and reimagination, if you will, in the mid to late 90s. Of course, you still had guys like Roger Clemens hanging on back then. This is before Roger went on to the Toronto Blue Jays. But, you had Mo Vaughn, you had Nomar, you had, a lot of the pieces that came together in the mid to late 90s that eventually culminated in the Red Sox, extremely successful days starting in 2004, even though Vaughn and Nomar weren't parts of that team. But, kind of what got the ball rolling in the mid to late 90s, Mo Vaughn was such a big part of it. And again, he was a big part in the community and all-star as well. But then, he had a lot of bad things going for him. He was a very vocal voice in the locker room, and not in a good way. He would, criticize team management. He would criticize the Boston media, which is never a smart thing to do. Never go head-to-head with the Boston media. He was packing on pounds as well. Because he was packing on the pounds, he was starting to feel the aches and pains of this extra weight. He after his time in Boston ends, he signs a massive contract with the Anaheim Angels. And, it it was a very messy breakup with the Red Sox, not only because he's fighting with the management, he's fighting with the ownership, you know, he's getting into these run-ins with the law, signs this massive contract with the Anaheim Angels. And even though he does very well, throughout 1999 and 2000, he was plagued with injuries, missed the entire 2001 season. And then what can truly be one of the most Mets deals ever made, other than the laughable Bobby Bonilla contract that the Mets are still paying out and will be paying out for, what, the next 8 years. The Mets take on this albatross of a contract. And, you know, if Vaughn's exit from Boston was messy, his exit from Anaheim was equally messy because the players didn't like him. And Troy Percival had a few things to say, you know, publicly about how the team was glad that Vaughn was gone. So Vaughn, you know, he's just like, well, you know, they don't have any banners to hang up in Anaheim. Well, what do you know? As the case would be in 2002, the Angels are hanging up a banner. They'd win the World Series in 2002. And, Mo Vaughn struggled. You know, he had a lot of injuries and, basically his career petered out in 2003 and 2004. Now, he was also roped into the steroid scandals. In fact, in the Mitchell report, there's a lot of paper evidence of Vaughn purchasing performance-enhancing drugs from Kirk Radomski. Vaughn said that a lot of the reasons, or the report said, because Vaughn has never publicly admitted to this, but the Mitchell report said that Vaughn purchased these drugs because he was trying to recover from those injuries in his time in Anaheim. And that was, again, you know, a lot of people forget about the main reason why PEDs and HGH was such a hot commodity in the late 90s and early 2000s. It wasn't necessarily guys just trying to hit more home runs. It was really veteran players trying to recover from injuries quicker than the human body would normally take to recover from major injuries. And, you know, Vaughn had a lot of problems. I think it was knee injuries that were giving him trouble. So here's a guy who's trying to justify that big contract that the Angels gave him, and the Angels are just floundering for a couple of years while he's there. He's trying to get one more big contract, and he wouldn't get that contract, but he was able to recover and justify the Mets foolishly spending the money on that contract where the last couple of years of his career went. Now, even though his career flamed out dramatically, and even though he was not well loved by the Red Sox media, certainly the management, the three-time All-Star and American League MVP of 1995 is in the Red Sox Hall of Fame. And in his post-playing career, he has been investing in a lot of real estate, a lot of distressed housing that he's part of a company that helps turn the housing around and then we'll rent this out. You know, they provide low-cost housing to a lot of people. So he's part of that. He's also part of a trucking company called Mo Vaughn Transport, which is kind of amazing when you think about it. Still very much seen and heard in New England and Boston. Like I said, he is a member of the Red Sox Hall of Fame. So even though it was a rather inauspicious conclusion to his career, Mo Vaughn still very much, for the most part, well-remembered and well-liked in New England, at least from what I've seen and heard, as he had a very positive impact there. Again, one of the first pieces, if not the first piece, of the rebuilding of the Red Sox, you know, moving on from the Roger Clemens, Wade Boggs, the Mike Greenwell, Ellis Burks Red Sox of the 1980s, and, you know, kind of the first piece of the rebuilding Red Sox of the 90s, which had Nomar and would later evolve into the Johnny Damon, Pedro Martinez, Curt Schilling Red Sox of the mid-2000s. So he was a very big part literally and figuratively, of the Red Sox rebuilds of the mid-1990s that kind of revived the Red Sox and got them back into the postseason and back into the national spotlight for many, many years. So there we go. Look at just some of the cards that we pulled from the first four packs of the box of the 92 Fleer. Again, 720 card set, a good value buy if you're looking for a nice card set that is very easy to collect, very affordable to collect, and also still has that little bit of a hook if you're looking for the Rookie Sensations cards, which are available in the Cello packs, or if you're looking for the All-Star cards or the Roger Clemens career cards. Those are still quite plentiful in the wax packs and boxes at affordable prices. Like I said, I got my box for $15. You can buy them pretty much anywhere for $15 to $20. And always better if you can buy them in a shop or at a card show. Save yourself that extra $14 or $15 for shipping if you're purchasing them online. But again, another fun bargain bin box buy. Just another one of those why not purchases. And even though I've got the empty calorie regret of opening these up and going, well, now what do I do with these? I will say it was fun while it lasted. It was that one night stand, you know. We've all been there at some point in our lives. It was fun while you were doing it, and then afterwards you had your regrets. But no regrets in chasing down that 92 Fleer box, and I'm sure the folks at Commons for Cards, or Commons for Kids, I'm mixing them up with Cadorty cards, but Commons for Kids will appreciate the rather sizable donation of 92 Fleer cards that are coming with some more recent Topps Heritage dupes and some late 70s and early 80s Topps cards that we will be donating shortly. We'll be making that part of a donation soon. Speaking of donations, again, if you want the purchases and the website that hosts Wax Ecstatic, Audio Boom, and all of our various channels, you can make your donation at paypal.me/waxecstatic, and we will take those donations and apply them appropriately to the program. And speaking of the program, we will be back 2 weeks from this Friday with another exciting show. I have no idea what it's going to be about, but I'm sure sometime between now and then, in the smoke and haze of the July 4th holiday, I will find something compelling to talk about. If not, I've got the 89 Bowman Rack Pack, and I may just unleash that on you as I make that threat just one more time. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for joining us on Wax Ecstatic, and we will see you next time.